academic career was as a research mathematician. He received his PhD from the University of Kentucky. He was on the math faculty for a few years at LSU, and he then moved to the University of Arkansas. So Razorbacks. The second and third pieces of his career were kind of happening simultaneously. So I'll talk about this individually because it makes it a little easier. He was involved with university administration for many years, both as a department chair and then as the dean at Arkansas. And he's got lots of good stories about being the dean at Arkansas. The other piece that was going on at this time was that he was involved in many issues that regard national policy, particularly mathematics education and national policy. He was the chief reader of AP Calculus and then went on to work with the College Board as chair of their Math Science Advisory Committee. He was also involved with Math Sciences for the year 2000 and worked on setting policy with many of the groups, the educational groups in Washington, D.C. The fourth piece of his career is quantitative literature. And that's why he's here today. And Bernie says that out of these four pieces of his career, he is having the most fun now. And what I want to do is allow him to explain to you why that is the case. So, Bernie Mac.
That sometimes makes me tired, but I did want to thank everyone here, the ACA in particular, for inviting us to come to Asheville. It's such a lovely time of the year, it's such a lovely place to be. I did notice, though, that Paul didn't mention, I don't think, something the cab driver told me. You get a lot of information from cab drivers. It's a long trip in the airport, and he talks all the time. He says that Asheville was the Beer City USA for the last 2 years. I asked him what that meant, and he said it has more microbreweries per capita than any city in the U.S. Well, I'm just quoting you. I haven't tried any of the beer. I was wrong. I grew up, and Karen had mentioned that I went to the University of Kentucky. I grew up in Kentucky, and very familiar with many of your member colleges here because I heard their names since I was about this tall, particularly Berea and Campbellsville and Lindsay Wilson. They're part of my past. And I'm really delighted that you're continuing to work with the other liberal arts colleges and to promote education. I'm here to talk about something though that I think is more that I want to be more serious about because Tom told me this was a tough audience. That's not the way he put it, but he said. He said, don't worry about them if they don't react to you. Don't worry about them if they don't they just sit there and look at you. I think that's what he said. But I want you to be a little bit more involved in this because I think this is an important opportunity that we have to improve education in the U.S. When I walk up here, I have this in my head. That's not all I have, by the way. I also have this is what Corey gave me, Corey Taylor, to announce the Saturday afternoon session, information session for NNN at 4:30 to 6 in the Magnolia Room. That will be the last slide in my presentation here, so you'll get that information again, as will an exhortation to fill out the form and put it in the boxes. Okay, so with that said, I do have a texture. I watched Bill Clinton for many years when he was governor of Arkansas and he was running for president and he was president. I watched Bill Clinton come to the podium with something smaller than this, and he would have he would have, and he kept it in his pocket, and he would write a few notes on it as he was talking to people before he got up to speak. And then he would get up to speak, and he could give an absolutely flawless presentation. Not as good as Hillary, because Bill would hesitate every once in a while, but Hillary never hesitates. If you watch her now and listen to her now, she delivers a talk without making a single stop or hesitation. She's just letter perfect. I think she learned that all from being a lawyer. What? Anyway, my comment here, Lynn Basher asked me, maybe you should say, if only math majors would lie. I said to Lynn, I said, this isn't my phrase. This is a phrase that belongs to somebody else. But I do agree that would is an appropriate alteration of that. About a decade ago, Bob Warren, Lindstein, and I were engaged in an extensive email conversation as we worked on Bob's initiative in QL. Snippets of those conversations are actually approximately recorded in Achieving Quantitative Literacy that Lynn wrote and was published by the MFA. As conversations between Bob Orwell, who's a historian as the outsider, and Lynn and me as mathematicians, who are the insiders. At some point in that conversation, I hope this works. At some point in that conversation, Lynn wrote to me in an email that quantitative literacy is a cultural field where language and quantitative constructs merge and are no longer one or the other. I believe that this observation captures the essence of QL and highlights why quantitative literacy is a better term for what we are doing than is numeracy, which is the term, by the way, used instead of quantitative literacy in most of the world. Bob, as I said, was a historian and a Rhodes Scholar, and he referred to himself as being quantitatively oblivious. In his essay in Calculation versus Context, Bob begins with an account of an encounter between philosopher George Santayana and Charles Eliot, then about 1890, president of Harvard College, who make the point that many in humanities, and that's a lot of you, I think, were discontent with the intrusion of quantitative issues into liberal education. Orwell writes, without much exaggeration, one could say that they, the humanists, entirely banished quantitative issues from their vision of liberal education. Orwell continued, this, I might add, was essentially the character of my own educational experience. As an undergraduate, my studies were mostly of a humanistic nature, and looking back, I cannot recall even once being asked to address a serious quantitative question in completing a large array of courses devoted to history, literature, philosophy, and the arts. This surely contributed to my becoming quantitatively oblivious. On the other hand, however, scientists and engineers were and are being educated with minimal attention to the humanities. Many mathematicians, including myself, were educated with little attention to the use of mathematics in the real world, much less in writing. A mathematics education that Alan Schoenfield has referred to as impoverished. My own school and college education had no art, no philosophy, and very little literature. Needless to say, merging mathematics and writing was not on the menu. Writing about mathematics, or even writing with numbers, was mostly restricted to research papers about mathematics, far from being popularized or integrated or reflected materials. The connections between mathematics, science and engineering, and the humanities were often limited to lunch. As Dean of Arts and Sciences for 10 years, I observed this given almost daily. Recent research results point to the effects of this kind of schism on our students. Analysis of the National Survey of Student Engagement and Faculty Survey of Student Engagement revealed some differences between STEM and non-STEM undergraduates with regard to approaches and learning that promote more complex, deeper understanding. Now, STEM here is science, engineering, and mathematics. Non-STEM is the arts, humanities, and the social sciences. Sometimes the social sciences are open STEM. In general, STEM faculty use pedagogies that encourage higher-order integrated and reflective learning significantly less than non-STEM faculty. And STEM seniors experience deep approaches to learning less than seniors in non-STEM fields. My hypothesis today is that we are all losing because we do not take advantage of each other's learning and our discipline's ways of knowing. And most of all, our students are losing. The humanities side of writing and critical reading, communication either. The humanities students in our mathematical reasoning class quite often are talented writers, but many profess being terrible at mathematics and statistics. What they are, in many cases, like Bob Earl, are quantitatively oblivious. Of course, they are quite capable of quantitative reasoning, and most of them begin to temper this pessimism before the semester ends. One of the case studies in the book of case studies that we use is a study of an article in Forbes magazine by Danny Seligman, titled, Why a Journalist Can't Act. And shown here, Seligman starts out saying, liberal arts graduates control the media, which doubtless helps the pros, but generates endless screw-ups and numbers. What he ends the article with is my title today, If Only the Math Majors Could Cry. Now, the two cultures of CPs know, and he states them, may be an exaggeration of what we have today in the quants versus the humanists. But we are not really very far away. Earl's suggestion for bringing the humanists into the conversation sounds correct to me. Quote, humanists are more likely to enter the conversation and remain if they can begin on familiar ground. At the same time, this would bring QL into contact with documents and texts about which it has so far had little to say. Here, then, might be the makings of a genuine conversation. Now, one might question whether this schism is really a problem. The reasonable, don't fix the unbroken query. If the humanists have done quite well without numbers for all these years, and science and engineering have surely thrived without, wherein is the problem? Well, in short, society, and especially U.S. society, has become so quantitatively complex that QR is no longer a luxury or an elective. It's liberating and essential. Whether you are an engineer or a poet, sound QR is needed for both citizenship and personal prosperity, to say nothing of the workplace. Numbers are everywhere. As stated in Mathematics and Democracy, we are awash in numbers. Now, Andrew, last one is this one. Stated this very cleverly with this, for a good or ill, numbers are today's preeminent public language, and those who speak it rule. Quick and cool, numbers seem to conquer that. Wish I could write about that. And Neil Lessie, in another nice turn of language, said numbers are not only important because they're pervasive because they're important, giving both sides of the coin. I'm not speaking about the need for mathematics of Euclid and Euler, more algebra, geometry, and calculus. The need is quite different, more critical, and more complex. As Lynn Singh characterized QL, I'm speaking about the sophisticated use of elementary mathematics and statistics, often in very sophisticated and complex contexts. Quality writing is not only engaging and elegant, but also integrative and reflective. What STEM students need. QR is essential for life in the U.S., so humanities students need to learn the reading quantitatively. So we have a window of opportunity here to make significant educational progress by merging QR with writing, having math majors who can write, and English majors who can count. So, why writing with numbers? Here I have listed six things. I could list more. To strengthen the academic arguments in all disciplines, to strengthen quantitative reasoning and literacy, to interpret and improve public discourse, to encourage cross-disciplinary cooperation and understanding, and to prepare for the workplace. Quantitative reasoning can strengthen argumentation in writing in many ways, adding evidence, framing, focus, and precision. As the Carleton College folks discovered in assessing students' writing portfolios, many opportunities were missed in using QR in argumentation. You will find that also among your students unless intervention has taken place. As Brown Roots in Numeracy 2009 noted, academic arguments, analysis of a poem or short story, a historical event, a political outcome, an economic calamity, a journalistic coup, etc., involve construction of meaning based on evidence. QR supplies an important category of evidence for successful argument. Reason number two to merge quantitative constructs with language is to strengthen quantitative reasoning. Using QR in writing requires students to find and evaluate quantitative information. It's not so hard to find information in the age of Google, but evaluation is more challenging. Too much information can lead to fragmented and awkward argument. I recently heard an NPR commentator posit that the amount of information flowing to teenagers has increased more in the past 10 years than in the previous 570 years since Gutenberg introduced book printing. My own school, also at Wings Grants, pointed to a reason why students do not write using helpful QR. My little said most do not know how to express simple quantitative ideas in clear English. Many will confuse, for example, the percentage of males who are smokers with the percentage of smokers who are male. Why not? Even the writers in the New York Times do this. This is an example of two different lead sentences in an article in the print version of the New York Times and the online version. They were reporting on a survey, and the sentence in the first one, the whole there is women. While the whole in the second, in the bottom one, is the women in the labor force. Someone discovered this between the print version and the online version and changed it. Now this was an experienced writer for the New York Times, and who is quite good. So this is not simply our students and confusing smokers who are male with males who are smokers. Recently, three colleagues, Shannon Dingman, Stuart Borsum, and Karen Dietzenberger, and I developed a rubric restoring student QR work. The report of that work is in the current issue of Numeracy. And just for a moment, I'd like to thank Lynn Basher and Dorothy Wallace for making Numeracy the shining beacon in QR education. We began with the AAC and U value rubric that was designed for institutional level assessment of QL or QR. There will be some details of that that Karen and I in session following this, this lunch. But writing, rather reading and writing, was a large part of that group. There are six core competencies, shown here with a brief description of each. Representation, interpretation, representation, calculation, analysis, slash synthesis, assumptions, and communication. The two in blue there have to do with critical reading and writing. And in fact, the interpretation, we actually map these six core competencies onto the study questions in our casebook that we use in our classes, and found interpretation and communication present in answering 65% of the questions, communication present in answering 23% of the questions. The 23% is too small, and will be larger in the third edition that we are now preparing. One of the things we learned by applying the rubric to our study questions was to word the questions more clearly and explicitly to elicit communication. The third reason to merge words and numbers is to interpret and improve public discourse. Often graphics and other mathematical representations need some written explanation. Writing an explanation reveals meaning. Some examples may defy an explanation. I would really like to hear an explanation of this one. Or I'd like to go and buy one of those. But anyway, in this particular case, the person who prepared the bar chart on the right probably did not write the explanation on the left, because the explanation on the left says that the number of division of children in family service caseworker training increased by 15% from August to October. If you look at the information on the right, it doesn't say that at all. It says the percent of physicians filled increased by 15 percentage points from August to October. The number of caseworkers actually increased from 91 to 118, and that's about 30%. So whoever writes the explanation needs to understand the representation and vice versa. I'll give you a second to figure this out. And you'll figure out that it's going to take longer than that. It's a fortuitous use of a pie chart that amounts up to some 300%. And in fact, the scale is not very good either. But the bases are all different. So this is the kind of thing that if you tried to explain it, you'd understand it. You'd understand it as wrong. It's really dead wrong. And it is not enough to do the USA Today graphic down in the lower left-hand corner and let it go. It's enough. You need some writing to go along with that to make sure that you do actually understand it. I have many more examples like this, but some of them are quite accurate and informative if one can understand them. All of them show, though, that the importance of quality writing and explaining mathematical representations. Now, some people apparently believe, as illustrated here and the other one, that numbers and statistics don't need any explanation. That numbers and statistics are indisputable. Indeed, often they are, because they're not understood. The catchphrase, just do the math, is a signal of this infallibility. Now, contrary to this New Yorker cartoon, numbers, statistics do not necessarily speak for themselves. Again, contrary to this Frank and Ernest cartoon, numbers can be used to deceive. Decisions by people to create statistics, perhaps not as casually as this Dilbert cartoon. I always time my students when I show them what it is. I show them a cartoon that has to do with money, with numbers, and they look at you and say, And then you explain it to them, and they say, And then the next time they see it, they laugh. So, because they know what the humor is. But this humor is pretty much in your face. Joel Bass has written a lot about socially constructed statistics. People decide whether to count, what to count, and how to summarize the counts. This means numbers, or quantities, which are numbers with units, are almost never beyond question, and questions involve language. I do recommend, say, two books, if you want to read some essays about this. Joel Beth's latest book on stat spotting, with the binoculars, he obviously is trying to take off on bird watching or something. But that's why the field guide for this time dubious data. I don't know what he didn't say
detecting dubious data, but maybe not.
Maybe they talked about it. And then the type that it isn't,
which is the UK version of the book I referred to earlier by Glasson and Dillon. There's 5 essays in there. They are delightful, and I actually prefer the British version of them to the US version of them because the humor is a little sharper somehow. Reading essays in these will give you an awareness of how statistics are confused or misrepresented in public media. The fourth reason I listed for to merge numbers and words is to encourage cross-disciplinary cooperation and understanding. We need more interdisciplinary crosstalk. We need to reconcile language among our disciplines. Even mathematics and physics have different language and customs regarding a simple quadratic expression. Students need to understand nominal dollars, GDP, Dow Jones Industrial Average, S&P 500, the body mass index, cost of living index, etc., etc., etc. We need to broaden and deepen the conversation on campuses about quantitative reasoning. It's far too casual and not nearly as engaging as it needs to be. We need to change journalists' views that it is okay not to write about numbers or to mangle bases for percentages. Recall the Dan Seligman article in Forbes magazine. Between the top part and the bottom part, he gives about 6 examples of these screw-ups. One is by Ellen Goodman, one is by William Sapphire, names that are legendary in writing in the media. I've talked to journalists who are quick to say that they don't do numbers. Some writers have addressed this issue, and some are very talented in doing so. Here's one. Dan O'Krent, who was a public editor of the New York Times until 2005. You may know Dan O'Krent from another life. He was the inventor of fantasy baseball some years ago, which had grown into fantasy football and fantasy everything else. Sometimes Dan says the absence of a number is as deflating to an article's credibility as the presence of a deceptive one. Few articles noting that President Bush 2000 received more votes than any candidate in history, also mentioned that more people voted against him than any candidate in history. Quoting Michael Moore's assertion that standing ovations in Greensboro, North Carolina, that's where we are, we're on the other end of the state, proved that Fahrenheit 9/11 is a red state movie, we're in a red state,
disregards the fact that metropolitan Greensboro has over 1.2 million people. You could probably,
this is really neat,
you could probably find a population that large enough to people to give a standing O for the reading of the violence of the American Dinner Society.
Now, that's right. That's good, right? People could. Here's one of the most talented science writers that I know, Gina Pallotta of the New York Times. This is an article about the body mass index using the presidents of the United States, current and past. It was pre-Obama. It was when George W. Bush was in the White House. It says, there's an overman weight man in the White House, and his name is George W. Bush. She's talking. Yes, the president of the United States, known for his robust good health, is officially overweight according to the standards of the National Institute of Health. At 6 feet, 194 pounds, students can learn to reason quantitatively. These students can learn to write mixed words with numbers. Like writing and critical reading, QL and QR is best addressed across the curriculum. But academic leadership for QR is probably the most daunting obstacle we face. Some, for example, Neil Lutke, who's here, and Joel Bass, argue that Winstrad in 2007 that mathematicians should not could not lead QR. Engineer turned mathematics educator Hugh Burkhardt argued that if mathematicians do not do it, it would not happen. One of the first articles I ever wrote about QL was entitled Quantitative Literacy, Everybody's Problem. Most disciplines, and especially mathematics, are inward-looking. Mathematicians are inclined to look for motivation to learn more mathematics. Quite frankly, most of our disciplines do not see a clear role in general education. And now that general education demands are so enormous, there is quite a deficit of attention. And this is a growing failure of higher education, the lack of attention to general education. My final reason is surely not in depth to prepare for the workplace crisis. Economist Corey Taylor in a Wingspread essay on QL for the workplace noted that QL is a type of literacy and, quote, communicating effectively about quantitative topics emerged from almost every source that Corey cited. Is this a K-12 problem? To some extent, yes. But teaching words and numbers together is more sophisticated than the way we teach writing and mathematics in K-12. The interdisciplinary nature makes this at least a 10-14 issue. At Wingspread, Rich Shavelson, the conference keynoter, argued that a proper response to QL crisis is not a special focus on QL for prospective or practicing teachers, but a broad focus for all students, especially at the introductory college level. So it's our problem, and we need to take the lead in finding reasonable responses. Our mathematical reasoning course at the University of Arkansas that we now taught for some 7 years, we've all had significant writing components. But one of our sections of mathematical reasoning has emphasized writing more than others. In fact, in the spring term, it will be taught with our English Composition 2, a combined 6-hour course with credit in Math 2813 and English 1023. There are four major paper assignments in this course. A 1-to-2-page critical response essay, we have to learn what that is. A 2-to-3-page evaluation synthesis. A 2-to-3-page argumentative synthesis. And 5-to-6-page research paper, all on quantitative topics. We will use three texts, St. Martin's Handbook, for a style manual that has both MLA and APA style. Students must learn to do both. And our mathematical reasoning book there, the casebook of case studies and quantitative reasoning, and the Chicago Guide for Writing the Numbers, which, by the way, is a very nice piece if you haven't used it. One of the features is it gives a poor way to say something, a better way to say something, and a best way to say something, and give reasons for doing so. One of our problems is finding instructors. Many, almost all of our people do not feel very secure outside their silos of expertise. There are more college faculty willing to teach writing, or able to teach writing, than are willing or able to teach QR. To close, I hope we can find ways to engage all of us, humanists and others, in genuine conversations on our campuses about QR and put an end to the many apocryphal but close to the truth stories about unabashed admission being bad at math. I recently reviewed a pre-publication copy of a book by Jeff Bennett titled Math for Life, Crucial Ideas You Didn't Learn in School. Jeff opens with a multiple choice question. And here's the multiple choice question. Imagine if you were at a party and you just struck up a conversation with a dynamic, successful businesswoman. Which of the following are you most likely to hear her say during the course of your conversation? I really don't know how to read her, but I can't write a grammatically correct sentence. I'm awful at dealing with people. I've never been able to think logically. I'm bad at math. Jeff says that we all know the answer is E, because we've heard it so many times. But I'd like to put in a plug where I'd like to add an option F. I really would like to be better at writing with numbers. Thank you. I would ask to invite you to this meeting. I was also
out your forms and stuff it in the box so that you go out.
We're going to add a few more things. I'm sure we're going to be here all weekend long, so if you have questions, I'm sure we'd be happy to answer them for you. Please don't forget to fill out your evaluation, put them in the box before you leave. There are other people at the hotel with us. Please